Cheney had seen for himself at Halliburton how geopolitics, resource nationalism, and the emergence of large state-owned oil companies had pinched Western oil companies as they attempted to replace the equity reserves they pumped and sold each year. One purpose of the preconceived energy task force Cheney led was to prepare for legislation designed to open up Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Raymond supported Cheney's plan and railed regularly in public against what he regarded as the self-defeating energy policies of the United States, which restricted access to oil and gas on free market American territory while exacerbating the country's dependency on imports from unstable and nationalistic regimes. Compared with other oil majors, however, ExxonMobil was not a dominant player inside the United States. Chevron had inherited some of the longest-lived of Standard Oil's American oil properties in California, and Chevron and British Petroleum had moved more boldly than Exxon into the Gulf of Mexico when leasing opened during the Clinton administration. Exxon had opportunities to exploit oil and natural gas in Alaska, but held back from some expensive deals because Raymond had learned after the Valdez that the political risks posed by Alaska's frontier-minded political culture and populist governors were comparable to those in West Africa. Buoyed by the trust embedded in their long-lived friendship, Raymond and Cheney typically talked less about domestic oil policy issues than about developments overseas in the world's best-endowed regions. Raymond might report on conversations he had recently had with the President of Kazakhstan or the Foreign Minister of Saudi Arabia. He might relate to Cheney insights about the Saudi royal court or requests about some problem Saudi leaders were having with the Bush administration. Cheney might share similar notes from his own conversations with foreign leaders. In protocol, power, and habit of mind, Raymond and Cheney were each, in effect, deputy heads of state. They traveled frequently and met with kings and presidents and perhaps ministers or chiefs of national oil companies, but rarely anyone less powerful. When the friends gathered in Washington, their meetings were strictly business. If Raymond needed only 10 minutes to make his request about a Kazakh trade issue, for example, and Cheney was quickly satisfied with the ExxonMobil chief's arguments, Raymond would not waste the vice president's time any further. In the White House, a one-hour meeting was a lengthy one, and Lee Raymond knew what it was like to have a daily schedule that was oversubscribed. ExxonMobil's interests were global, not national. Once, at an industry meeting in Washington, an executive present asked Raymond whether Exxon might build more refineries inside the United States to help protect the country against potential gasoline shortages. "Why would I want to do that?" Raymond asked, as the executive recalled it. "Because the United States needs it, for security," the executive replied. "I'm not a U.S. company, and I don't make decisions based on what's good for the U.S., Raymond said. ExxonMobil executives managed the interests of the corporation's shareholders, employees, and worldwide affiliates that pay taxes in scores of countries. The corporation operated and licensed more gas stations overseas than it did in the United States. It was growing overseas faster than at home. Even so, it seemed stunning that a man in Raymond's position, at the helm of an iconic century-old American oil company, a man who was a political conservative friendly with many ardently patriotic political office holders, could be so bold, so brazen. Raymond saw no contradiction. He did indeed regard himself as a very patriotic American and a political conservative, but he also was fully prepared to state publicly that he had fiduciary responsibilities. Raymond found it frustrating that so many people, particularly politicians in Washington, could not grasp or would not take the time to think through ExxonMobil's multinational dimensions and what the corporation's global sprawl implied about its relationship with the United States government of the day, on climate above all. After the merger, ExxonMobil moved its Washington, D.C. office from Pennsylvania Avenue to K Street, in the heart of the Capitol's lobbying district. The office occupied one high floor of a new complex constructed from pink granite and concrete. A turret, topped by an American flag, distinguished the building from the Legoland of downtown Washington. Landscape paintings lined the walls of ExxonMobil's suite, Antique mobile oil cans and Esso signs decorated the shelves of its conference rooms. The furniture and dark cherrywood paneling created a formal and professional atmosphere, but the office eschewed the garish luxuries of the capital's big law firms and the D.C. outposts of Wall Street investment banks. By the time of the merger with Mobil, the office's director, James Rouse, had been with the company for 37 years. The resumes of the lobbyists he hired spoke of technical competence and stolidity. ExxonMobil's strategy was not so much to dazzle or manipulate Washington as to manage and outlast it.